few thousand. I figure the loot on this deal at 2 million.
There should be that much in the track offices.
Big dollar sign there where most women have a heart. So play it smart. Stay in character and you'll have money. Plenty of it. George will have it. He'll blow it all on you.
Johnny, I'm no good for anybody else. I'm not pretty and I'm not very smart, so please don't leave me alone anymore.
So what makes you think or know that you're going to have several hundred thousand dollars?
Because I do. I just can't talk about it, that's all.
Not even to me, your little share.
I shouldn't have even mentioned I was going to have it. Not that I mind. I know I can trust you. But if these other guys
these
ever...
other guys?
I can't talk about it, Cherry.
You've been talking. Now you spilled to her.
Oh, I didn't, honest. What, do you think I'm crazy? I wouldn't...
Jerk, you clown! Come on, clown. Sing us a chorus from Pagliacci.
Hey, where's the jerk? Where's George?
Welcome to Movie Humpers. My name is Bob Sham.
I'm Angela.
This month, our theme is the left-hand endeavor. That means it's hard-boiled-ass noir, hard-boiled Jews, heartless dames, and one last job before you say goodbye to all of it.
That's one of the major noir tropes. Is someone just got out. There's a girl who's been waiting, but they need one more job before they can live the rest of their lives.
This is probably our most pure heist movie this month. I'm trying to recall what we've discussed so far. I don't think there's actually that many like pure heists like there is one in here. This is the plan. Let's do this. Let's do this. And it's a good plan. And it works. Spoiler, it works. But this is also... happens to be our third Stanley Kubrick movie discussion.
The fact that Stanley Kubrick made this movie so long ago.
He considered it his first mature film.
And he also is the same man who made Eyes Wide Shut. I've just been thinking about that.
Yeah.
Over the last few days. Kubrick, what is it? He comes out with like a movie every decade or something.
No, he was a bit more prolific than that in his time.
Not too much more. Like by the end, every 5 years.
By
or
the
so,
time maybe. Eyes Wide Shut came out, yeah, it'd been like well over a decade.
Maybe that's what I was thinking, is that it had just been like a long break at that point.
But yeah, this is the guy that made 2001 and Barry Lyndon and Clockwork Orange, those movies. He had a war movie. I can't remember. I think it was after this, called... Paths of Glory had Kirk Douglas in it. I have seen it. It's just been quite a long time. And this one, it's noir month, the left-hand endeavor. So if you know about Stanley Kubrick, you know he's got a well-made little noir here from 1956. This is our second youngest movie we'll be discussing this month.
I love the way you say that.
Yes, it's not our youngest movie. That will be later this week. In our foreign selection.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is the second most recent movie all month long that we will be discussing. It's the 1956 film, The Killing.
Dun, dun, dun.
And of course, you're conscious that when the movie's starting and you're seeing all these cool little shots and how everything is framed and set up, you can see, I mean, you are going in it with the Stanley Kubrick made this guy, this very controlled dude. He did write it with Jim. He did co-write this with Jim Thompson, who wrote a lot of classic noir fiction like The Killer Inside Me and stuff like that. Though Stanley only credited him as the dialogue writer in this movie. Like, he pointedly made him his writing credit be very specific.
He's like, I'm responsible for every movement they made.
Yeah.
Everything except some of the words.
And And they were supposed to work together on another project, and it fell through, but this is based on a book by Lionel White, and it stars Sterling Hayden, Alicia Cook Jr., Marie Windsor, Colleen Gray, Ted DeCorsia, and the pro wrestler Kola Quariani. Not one of the most famous pro wrestlers in history, but you see him do his shit, and yeah.
Did you just say three women's names, or is one of those maybe a man? Because I can only remember two George, women in this entire movie.
George is Alicia Cook Jr.
Okay.
Who's married to...
So his name is Alicia.
Sherry.
Okay.
Yeah, Alicia Cook Jr.
Interesting. I've never heard that as a man's name.
Yeah, it's like maybe back in the day, like when more dudes were named Leslie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I saw that. I was like, oh, that's interesting.
There are two women in this movie. And I know the majority of this movie is about the heist and these men. But these two women, if you stand them up next to each other, it's kind of crazy. Because you've got Sherry, who's married to George.
Sherry, baby!
Sherry! Sherry, baby!
Remember that song?
Yes, I love that song. It's fun.
Hi.
Sherry baby.
those high notes on the early Four Seasons songs are
I'm gonna make you mine.
Nuts.
I love it.
I'm sorry. Go
no,
ahead.
No, that's okay. So you meet Sherry second. First, you meet our main character's girl, who's been waiting for him to get out of prison for 6 years. She thinks so little of herself. It's actually sad. She at one point says to him,
"Everything is going to be all right. I promise you.
Make sure you're right about it, Johnny. I'm no good for anybody else. I'm not pretty and I'm not very smart, so please don't leave me alone anymore.
Nothing is going to happen. Not this time.
I'm not pretty and I'm not smart, so it's not like anybody else would want me." And
you look at her and she's like, you're actually... Well, she doesn't look like Ava Gardner in a noir film.
No,
so.
But listen, she's pretty.
Yeah.
But he doesn't say,
nah.
"Baby, you're pretty." Baby, he just says, "Go buy the plane tickets." Listen, the idea that she says she's followed him since they were kids. She's been in love with him since they were kids. I know we'll talk about how this movie plays out, but he has essentially ruined her. Because at this point, if she wasn't waiting for him at this time when this is set, she's an old maid.
Yeah.
She's been waiting for him to come back and marry her and, you know, start her life. She's been on hold.
I know I'm not a pretty woman. I'm not very smart.
Ugh.
My vagina's probably closed up at this point, but...
There's like tumbleweeds down there. Listen, they kiss, I think. They hug. And then he tells her, "Get the fuck out of here. I don't want to see you until Saturday. Like, you cannot be involved in what I'm about to do."
Mm,
fair. Fine.
Sure.
Then
you got Sherry Petey.
Sherry Petey.
Who is more... It's not like a reveal of, like, this is a bad dame at the end. It's like, nah, she's bad. She's greedy.
She only thinks about herself from the very first moment.
Yeah, you read it quick that she's just no good.
Yeah, we meet her, and she literally says to her husband,
"Tell me something, would you, Sherry? Just tell me one thing. Why did you ever marry me anyway?"
"Oh, George, when a man has to ask his wife that, well, he just hadn't better, that's all. Why talk about it? Maybe it's all to the good in the long run. After all, if people didn't have headaches, what would happen to the aspirin industry?"
Sherry or
you're
Faye.
You're hurting me.
Sherry or Faye, one night. You got to pick Sherry or
Sherry.
Faye. Yeah.
One night, Sherry. Marry, yeah. Faye.
Of course.
Like, yeah.
You marry the Faye. You marry the girl
but
that's waited
Sherry.
On you for 6 years.
Yeah.
Obviously, her self-esteem is completely shattered. That's probably a big part of why she waited on you that long.
But you
time.
You give Sherry a fake name,
mm-hmm.
and you go to a hotel.
And Sherry's done that
town.
A lot. You get the vibe that Sherry's done this a lot.
Yeah, Sherry, you know, she's two Tom and George.
Mm-hmm.
You find out very quickly she only married George because she thought that he was going to be successful.
Right. And he's just kind of a guy working a window at a racetrack.
He works a window at a racetrack, yeah.
Now, you're looking at the craft. Now, you're like, this is a Kubrick movie, so you're very focused in on the craft of it. And I found myself comparing it to some of the other things we watched this month. Like Kiss Me Deadly felt so sometimes random but experimental.
Mm-hmm.
it does feel stylistically it's going into more of the future. Whereas, you know, Kiss Me Deadly, the overall tone, we know it encouraged a lot of like French cinema in the 60s.
Absolutely.
So that also is going literally into the future. But there is just the technique of this one. I mean, there's not much more you can say about Stanley Kubrick. In case you hadn't heard, he's pretty good at directing movies.
This movie feels like a puzzle. And he's very strategically giving you the pieces in the order that he wants you to know them.
And there's a narrator, like it's a newsreel.
At 7:15 that same night, George Petey, the track cashier, arrived at his apartment.
I love this movie.
This movie's sharp.
I love,
man,
the way this movie is told. My favorite thing in a noir or a mystery is when you sort of get everyone's story from each different area, you know, like you kind of follow somebody for a bit, they get to a point and you go, okay, wait, at 10 o'clock that morning, this guy was doing this, like putting all these pieces together until by the time you arrive at the end, you understand what they've been doing. But it's little bits at a time, and it's so well done.
You know, it's not so obvious, like say in a Pulp Fiction, the structured time.
I was just thinking about that,
getting
though,
all pieced back together where everything is separate, but like you kind of can still make sense of it. But this movie is like that. You, it goes into each individual of a heist, and it's taking place at certain points, past points that you won't see until the first time, like maybe the scene after. Mm-hmm. But it works, and it makes it more thrilling. It makes it more tense. Mm-hmm. But Sterling Hayden, Johnny Clay, he's got this gig, and he's got some boys setting up. You got George Petey, who's married to that no good Sherry. He's working the window. He's got to let the boys in the back. Val Cannon, he's an old man that hangs out, I guess.
Well, he's the one that
I forget which ones
Johnny
are which.
Lives with, right?
Yeah.
So I think they met in prison, and he thinks of Johnny as a son.
No, Vince Edwards is the mobster guy that Sherry's fucking.
Oh, he's a young man.
Jay Flippin is the older man.
Okay.
He is Marvin Unger. That's his character's name.
Okay.
So, yeah. What does Marvin do specifically?
The older guy that Johnny lives with? So, he fronts the money to pay the day players. So, there's like five guys who are in this heist together, and they're going to split the money. Johnny arranges for two other guys to just do a job on the day and not get a cut. So, one of them is to shoot a horse.
Yeah.
And one of them is to start a fight. And that's what that guy does. Marvin fronts the money. He actually says at one point, I wish I could do more. And Johnny's like, your money is doing enough. Mm-hmm. And also, if this doesn't go down, you're going to be out that money. Yeah. And he's like, no, it's going to go down. I trust you. You're like a son to me. At one point, he tries to convince Johnny to not marry his like sweetheart, but to go away with him instead.
Wouldn't it be great if we could just go away, the two of us, and let the old world take a couple of turns and have a chance to take stock of things? It can be pretty serious and terrible, particularly if it's not the right person. Getting married, I mean.
Got a little rope thing going on here.
I mean,
let's go on vacation together.
He said he's like his son, but we all know that whole daddy thing can be a...
Ted DeCorsia plays the policeman, Randy Keenan, who is a corrupt cop who's in on it, and he owes some money. And so he's in on this job so he can pay back $3,000 to some mobster that he's in the pocket for. Yeah, they pay one guy, and it all does go down. And one of the guy that they pay to start a fight is this Russian wrestler.
He's cool.
Who is really into chess. And apparently Stanley Kubrick was also into chess. And there is I found this picture online of, I'll throw it right up, of the March 1956 issue of Chess Review, the picture chess magazine. And on the cover of that, it has Sterling Hayden, Stanley Kubrick, and Kola Quariani playing chess.
Nice.
It's a cool picture. Remind me to show it to you later. Okay. You can't see my screens.
I cannot.
They put them on the cover for that year, which is fun. Kola Quariani, he's one of my favorites in the movie. He's Maurice Aubakoff, who really was a wrestler and knew Bruno Sammartino apparently really well. But he does start the fight in the bar, and he's doing straight-up wrestle moves. Like, he's picking him up. He's like, whoa. He's, like, doing arm drags. We like wrestling. We watch wrestling. So when we saw this shit happen, we got kind of excited.
I got very excited.
It's like, wrestling! And let me tell you, if you're thinking like, look, I like movies, but that wrestling, it's too fake. Action movies? Wrestling.
It's all wrestling.
It's fucking wrestling. Mm-hmm. Literally, you watch enough wrestling, you go back and watch these action movies. Like in the Black Widow Marvel movies.
Oh my gosh.
She's doing like lucha moves.
Absolutely.
Hurricane Rana 5 times in every movie she's in. Y'all watch wrestling, you don't even know it. The dude that they pay to shoot the horse.
Yes.
It's quite an interesting scene because he's pulling into this lot and it's closed. But he bribes this guy who's working the window and he's a black man.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy like takes to him because he's very kind and he's very polite to him. But the time is coming where a horse is supposed to go around the track. He can't just shoot the horse before the race stops because that would stop the whole race.
Mm-hmm.
But if he can shoot the horse and make it fall, the job will be done before they can investigate what actually happened. So when the horse is rounding, the guy keeps coming back and forth and he's being very polite. And to get the guy away from him, and you get the feeling that he does like the dude.
He did.
But he straight up like goes full racist on him to get him to go away. Tense as shit. But the police corner him quick because the guy maybe called someone after he was rude to him. And he had a horseshoe. He's like, I know you're betting on this horse. I want to give you this horseshoe. Insults him. And so he takes off. And when he tries to back out to escape, apparently the guy just dropped the horseshoe by the tire. And the horseshoe pierces the tire. And he gets shot down by police. So that guy, he can't collect.
The reason he has to shoot the horse at the moment that he does is because the whole heist is planned around the 7th race of the day. And so when the 7th race begins is when they all are supposed to be in place and have this whole thing go. So the idea is that Maurice starts the fight and all the cops run to there to try to break it up, which it takes like 12 guys.
Yeah.
The horse gets shot, which makes chaos happen out on the field. So if the cops are not with the guy starting the fight, they're going to be running out to see what the hell happened or to find who shot.
And George is the one that opens the door after the cops come out to get
Johnny
into the back.
Yes. And he puts on the scariest mask.
Pretty infamous image from this movie is Johnny Clay wearing this clown mask.
It's so creepy and so good.
Yeah, he holds it up and fills up. And after he packs this bag, it's $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
He gets them all to go into the locker and he shoves it out the window. And then he does a quick change where he's got a whole other suit like under his suit.
Puts on glasses.
He looks like a Clark Kent type. And it looks like a cop does kind of make him or notices he's suspicious, but he knocks him out.
Well, and Maurice is right there and Maurice kind of distracts a little bit too. Like I think he was just there to jump in front of somebody if needed.
And the crooked cop, Randy, he's the one that takes when the money goes out the window, he's the one that's there. And no one's going to suspect why a cop would be around that area.
Mm-hmm.
But he also played up that he was calling to the station from a payphone to play up that he's not sure if his radio is working right. Could you check and see if my connections work? Oh, it looks good on your end? I'll have to fiddle with it. I don't know what's going on.
It's actually really brilliant because you find out later that he did that. So they might doubt his radio. He's like, but at the end of the day, they're going to think I was drinking.
Yeah.
So it just makes me look like I was probably drunk at a bar somewhere. And so that's my alibi.
So when it comes down to it, he'll just confess like, yeah, I was drunk.
I'm so sorry. It's interesting because the other men involved are the bartender. That was the other guy. It was like the cop, George, Johnny, Maurice, and the bartender were the main 5.
Yeah.
And then you had our guy who starts the fight and our guy who does the shooting, but our shooting guy is dead.
Mm.
And our guy who started the fight gets carted off to jail. I liked the small detail that he went back to the chess place and was like, if I'm not back here by 6:30, call this number and say I need this guy's services, which means he was just lining up a lawyer.
Yeah.
To get him out of jail.
Right.
Which is great.
So Johnny's got like a little motel, little house somewhere where he's stashing all this shit. He's supposed to give it a little time and then come back and reconvene and then they can all go get the money.
Yeah, the cop left the money at the hotel for Johnny to come get later, yeah.
Because he's supposed to be the last one to show up anyway. And all the people that are involved are in this place.
And George is freaking the fuck out and he has a gun. And no one else knows that he does. But he's been freaking out all day. And the, one of the reasons he's been freaking out is because earlier on, Sherry goaded him into telling her what was going on.
Right.
And she, like, showed up one night when they were having a meeting. And they, like, roughed her up and was like, "You," not really. They didn't hurt her. But it was, like, tried to scare her. Like, "You can't be talking about this." He was just nervous the whole time that something was not going to go right.
Sure enough, some gangsters show up. One of them is the guy she was fucking.
Sherry's boyfriend.
And, but George.
She told.
And there's a bit of a standoff, but the money's not there yet.
"Hey, where's the jerk? Where's George?"
"The jerk's not."
But George pops off. He's so fucking angry and wild about his shady ass wife that he pops off and a bunch of shoot, like, it's just wild shooting. And when the dust settles, everyone is fucking dead except George. And but Sherry's not there. Mm-mm. She's waiting for her mobster boyfriend to show up with the money.
And Johnny.
And then they're going to take off. And he shows up at the house. But George is wrecked. Like, he's been shot
up. Yeah, he was so wrecked that Johnny had pulled up in front of the meeting place. And George just walked right past his car. Like, didn't even recognize. And so Johnny was like, "Something went down, I'm leaving."
George only had one thing on his mind. "I'm going to go kill that bitch." Yep. And he goes to the house. And she's, like, up in her lingerie about to put her, like, her underwear about to put her dress on.
The door opens. She's like, "Come on in, baby. I'm almost packed."
Yeah, and it's George all wrecked up. And he's like,
"I'm sick, Sherry. I'm calling ambulance.
The door's behind you. Take a cab."
"I love you, Sherry."
"George, you better go on and go. You look terrible."
"Fuck you," basically, and shoots her right there.
"I never had anybody but you. Not a real husband. Not even yet. Just a bad joke without a punchline."
But he falls down dead and dies from his wounds.
And the parrot says something.
The parrot was just like a budgie, too. I don't think they talk, but whatever. I think that's what those are called.
I can talk a little bit.
Beats me. We're not bird experts, so maybe don't write down that last 10 seconds of dialogue. Birds. So Johnny's like, fuck. Well, he gets his suitcase. He puts all the money in the suitcase after he drives somewhere to a specific place very clumsily. So much that loose money is just blowing around everywhere.
And there's a foreshadowing because he tries to lock the suitcase. He bought it from a pawn shop and he can't get it to lock on one side. Yeah, you
specifically see him struggle with that.
And then he locks the other. Now, he earlier in the day went to the airport and checked the rest of his baggage and plans to take this on the plane with him. But it is a big suitcase. And his girl is at the airport waiting for him. They're supposed to fly out at 9 p.m.
And there's this whole exchange where he wants to take the suitcase on. And Johnny, the rules have been the same for over half a century.
Yep.
You can't take a big ass suitcase onto the plane with you. It's still like that to this very day. But then finally, he just gives in, like, okay, check it back. He's very nervous about it. And his girl is very nervous as well. She kind of knows that something is up. So they're watching. And the cops are also looking for a guy. They know that they're looking for someone.
And this is a period in time where if you were going to get on a plane, you would wait out on the tarmac, like, for people to get off the plane and for you to get on the plane. And there is this woman with this little poodle. And this woman is talking to the little baby doggy like this, like, "Daddy's going to come off the airplane in a minute."
That fucking dog.
And the fucking dog takes off running. The guy in the cart pulling the luggage, like, the suitcase is already going like this. You're already like, that suitcase is going to fucking fall. But then he has to, like, swerve to miss this idiot small dog. I love dogs, but this dog should have been on a leash.
I
blame the woman.
In the 20th century, you could just walk into the airport and go eat lunch.
Absolutely.
Have a cocktail at the
airport. Smoking cigarettes on the plane.
Yeah. I saw someone said, and I never thought about this, that for all the extra security we've had since 9/11 at airports, that you could still just walk into baggage claim and take a fucking bag.
Yes. Yes.
A bag you see going around, no one's claiming. You could grab that shit and no one's... I mean, you'll probably be on camera, but will those employees take that time to do that detective work?
Part of John Waters' newest book, Liar Mouth,
yeah,
is a con. That is one of the cons that the people run. It's so interesting because, yeah, you just go in and pretend like you're supposed to be there.
Baggage claim at airports are still like pre-9/11 style. So Johnny is watching the baggage claim and he sees his big ass suitcase not stacked very well on the back of this thing. And then the dog gets away from the lady. Swerve. Sure enough, the suitcase flies off, pops open. And it's like a tornado, wind tornado of money. It just spread all over the tarmac.
And their faces just went like dead.
I felt that. I felt that. I felt the deflation. I was deflated for them.
And immediately he grabs her elbow and they start walking out of the airport.
And the last scene is the concierge or whatever pointing at Johnny through the glass doors.
They're calling his fake name over the intercom.
And then two cops go through the doors and start to close in, and that's the last shot you see.
I love that as the last shot.
Yeah.
Oh, because basically she goes,
Johnny, you've got to run.
He's like,
what's the difference?
What's the point?
What's the difference?
He's got no money to run with. Yeah. It's all, he can't pay his boys. A dude died. All of his boys died. The wrestler ain't going to get money, so he's going to need that lawyer.
And you know, that little girl, Faye.
Yeah.
She's going to turn into the sad part of It's a Wonderful Life when Miss Thing.
She's going to just be a librarian.
Shriveled up and was working in the library.
She's going to wear.
Scared of everything.
She's going to wear glasses. That's fucked up.
So sad.
That's The Killing. A great movie. Great solid movie. Noir. Great movies all month long here.
Absolutely.
Even the ones that aren't great are still good.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of fun. I love movies like this. I think I've said that 20 times so far. But we're going to rate this, give it 1 through 5 each, combined for best out of 10. Let me go first. 4.5. Maybe one of the best heist movies ever. I'm definitely over a 4. I think a 4.5 feels right.
I'm going to give it a 4.75.
That makes Stanley Kubrick's The Killing an S-tier movie. Yeah. It's an S-tier. Stanley Kubrick's The Killing, one of our finest films. It is an S-tier classic noir. Definitely considered one of the great noirs out there. Mm-hmm. It shares the rankings with other great noirs, such as Out of the Past, The Night of the Hunter, and Sunset Boulevard, which we have discussed long ago. Those are our earliest noirs we discussed for the show.
Yep.
And they are on the YouTube playlist of The Left Hand Endeavor as well. So if you want to go back and check the audio, which is not as good as the audio here a little bit, but you know, check the show notes for links to other places to find us. Like, subscribe to the channel, leave a comment or a correction. I'm hoping we're recording a lot of these ahead of time, but I'm hoping these go well. I find that older movies seem to get a lot of traction, more so than like very modern stuff, which is a pleasant surprise. So yeah, leave a comment, tell us what you think, some of your favorite Stanley Kubrick movies, your favorite noir movies. Maybe we'll get to them down the road if we don't get to them this month. All right, so whichever guy was it, Edward G. Robinson or the other guy who says, what's our sign off, you got to put your nasal into it.
Yeah. See.